Football in Europe sponsored by betonbrazil.com. It's the betting site for all sports punters with great odds, markets and offers.
Listeners to this podcast can now get up to £60 deposit match when you use the promo code FIE60. Just visit betonbrazil.com and enter promo code FIE60 when you deposit and we'll match your deposit up to £60.
Also look out for our daily happy hour offers between 5pm and 6pm. Sign up now at betonbrazil.com. BetOnBrazil.com is for over 18s only, and betting should be fun, so please gamble responsibly.
You're listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello and welcome to Football in Europe. I'm Rob Daly. This is your weekly European football podcast. Alongside me is Chris Parrott. Chris, what are we talking about this week?
Plenty, Rob. Madrid's unbeaten run is over finally. Juve lose. Bayern go on their annual Bundesliga transfer pillage. And there's a Monaco stat attack for all the for everybody, but also for the Manchester City fans ahead of their Champions League tie.
Okay, and we do have Sonja Nikcevic coming up on the show today to talk about why Partizan Belgrade have been banned from playing in Europe. Chris, it's nice to be back in the studio.
It is. It's significantly warmer than outside as well.
It's warmer in here than it was in Marbella.
The big freeze.
It's horrible outside. So last week we were in Marbella for the show, and we were talking about the winter break and how teams have their training camps. Mm-hmm. And we've had lots of reaction, Chris, to the podcast and thoughts on the winter break in general, and quite varying ones. I mean, do you want to read out this one from Juan Torres, his opinion on winter breaks?
Yep, he says, mixed, good for players to get a long layoff, but in Italy that means more midweek fixtures. So what good is the long layoff if it just means three games in a week several times per season? And then there's the travelling support issue, which is interesting because if we talk about it in terms of the UK who don't have one, if they had a winter break, which I personally think they should, and I think it should be after the Christmas period because those fixtures are, you know, they're the essence of English football for me anyway, and for a lot of supporters, they would have to presumably cram more fixtures in later on in the campaign. You either elongate the season and start earlier, probably, or you have to have more games later on. So maybe players would be just as tired at the end of the season because, okay, they'd have the break now, but then they'd have, you know, two or three matches a week consistently at the end of the campaign.
It's interesting because Charlie's tweeted in to say it would be a good thing to have a winter break. And he says that the English Premier League would need one in the second and third weeks of January, or at least one weekend. Jonathan Stevens says it would be boring if we had a winter break in England. I don't care about tired players. If anything, they don't play enough. And Richard Wyatt says it's good for players, bad for the money men, and bad for fans in the UK who like the tradition of football over the Christmas period. I was chatting to my friend on Friday, Chris, about this, and I think we just need to get rid of the League Cup.
No, I like the League Cup.
Do you?
Yeah. Maybe the semi-final should be one leg for those teams. FA Cup has to remain the same.
You can't get rid of replays.
You can't get rid of replays. No. You know, Plymouth Argyle are going to make most of their... Not only are they a big club anyway, but they're going to, you know, make a huge amount of money because they went to Anfield and got a draw. And
sure,
that has to still be there. But yeah, League Cup is an interesting one. Maybe you could finish the League Cup earlier. You know, in some... It's sure there's one league where they've had the League Cup final already.
Well, we do have it quite early, don't we?
We have it in the middle of February. And of course, the fascinating thing is if Manchester United reach the final, then they're supposed to play Man City that weekend. So they'd be in the League Cup final instead. And the Man City game would probably go to the very end of the season.
Oh.
So you could have a midweek match.
Okay.
You know, last year when West Ham... They must have loved it when their game against United had to be rearranged. Because then Swansea City at home being the last game, they're like, well, we'll put Man United under the lights.
Okay, Chris, we're going to get on to that farewell. We're going to get on to La Liga in a moment. But Chris, let's have... I'll read out a couple of the highlights of the weekend here. Jalaham says, Fiorentina beating Juventus has to be the highlight of the weekend. And regular listener Mason Lemon, who tweets in a lot, tweeted us a picture from the game. So I'm guessing he was in Florence for the picture.
Great atmosphere.
So we'll talk about that a little bit later on. Chris, Ruben, this is our European factor... I don't even know how to describe it, but thing of the week, what's yours?
Well, now we can just call it a Reuben. Surely everyone
knows. I know, but there's new listeners, isn't there?
Oh, so yeah. You've got to think about it. Fact of the week to take down your pub with your mates.
That's it, yeah.
Now so be impressed. Mine comes from Real Madrid's unbeaten run came to an end at 40 matches. Pretty impressive. European football's longest ever unbeaten run. Who do you think set it? That's a very hard question. There's an awful lot of teams.
Hold on, hold on. So Real Madrid, there is a longest run.
There's a longest run, yeah.
And the Real Madrid isn't the one. They didn't beat the European one.
They're nowhere near.
I have no idea. Who the hell did that, Chris? As you scramble through your papers.
As I go from page 1 to 10 very quickly.
Just flick through.
So it is Steaua Bucharest.
Ah.
You know, when they were brilliant when they won the European Cup in the 80s. They went 106 matches unbeaten.
Did they really?
Round of applause for Steaua.
Who won't be Steaua for much longer. A little tease ahead.
A little tease ahead to a very
interesting story from Romania.
But 106, I think it was 86 to 89. 3 years. I mean, whoever ended that unbeaten run, must have been
a
heck of a game.
Yeah. My Ruben this week is about Valencia, which we're going to talk about in a moment. Since Unai Emery left Valencia in June 2012, possibly one of the biggest mistakes in recent history for Valencia, 9 different men have been given the Valencia job on a permanent basis. So that's 4.5 years, 9 different managers: Pellegrino, Valverde, Miroslav Dukic, Juan Antonio Pizzi, Gary Neville, Paco Yesteran, Cesare Prandelli, who very recently left, and now Nuno, who's had 3 caretaker spells and is now full-time head coach of Valencia until the end of the season. And his side did win at the weekend. We'll talk about that in a second.
Should have been given that job, Nuno, probably on most of those 9 occasions.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, let's talk about
actually,
Valencia.
Actually, just as you went through that list, I said, this is interesting, big names. And then you dropped Gary Neville in there.
That's peculiar, isn't it?
You know, it's not that long since it's happened. Give it 5 years. You're going to look back and you're going to be like,
what?
Gary Neville, Valencia man.
Yeah, but Phil was there, wasn't he, his assistant before that?
That's even more
curious.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's just, just as you know, we spoke about it a lot on this podcast and it was pretty mad at the time. But when you actually look back at it now, you're going to be like, that is just, well.
Yeah, I think it was on TalkSport or something.
Mad.
I was saying that you knew at the time it was weird.
Yeah.
You knew, everyone was like, what? But let's not coat off Gary Neville too much, poor guy.
Great pundit.
Let's speak about Valencia then, Chris.
They won.
Yeah, they did. Confirmed this week that Voro Gonzalez will be in charge until the end of the season. He took over in temporary charge, as he always does, in December after Prandelli's resignation. He was also caretaker boss after Paco Ayestarán was dismissed. Of course, Valencia as well have signed Simone Zaza on loan from Juventus after, look at this record he had at West Ham, Chris. No goal in 11 appearances for West Ham.
It wasn't just that. He looked absolutely awful.
He did look awful. And if he'd played 3 more times, West Ham would have had to sign him on a permanent deal for £20 million.
Yep. And yeah, which is why Slaven Bilic was very happy to see him go. First win since October in the league for Valencia. It's a long time, isn't it?
Staggering.
I mean, I think the win put them 4 clear of Sporting Gijón. I don't think they're going to go down. You know, that's 4 clear of third bottom. But still, you know, what happens now? It's a big few months until the end of the season. And if he does well, one imagines that he should get the job permanently in the summer, whether he does. And what happens with Peter Lim's ownership is very interesting. We had those, after the last defeat, you know, fans very unhappy, almost blockading the bus, leaving the Mestalla. Not happy camp. Fascinating to see what happens. But that seemed like an important win. And as I said, for a club like Valencia to go from October right through to January without winning a league game, that must be one of their worst runs in the club's
history. Absolutely. So they got a 2-1 win against Espanyol. I saw some highlights in the game. They did actually play some very nice football. Santi Mina with a rather scrappy winner, though, after a well-worked first. They've said as well that Zaza is a proven striker who was wanted by the previous coach and sporting director, and he's an international player. He's a player with character for Valencia. He's going to really have to turn around his form if he's going to impress there. The big story really from the weekend, Chris, was Real Madrid's unbeaten run coming to an end, and I think we both watched this game on Sunday evening as they lost 2-1 at Sevilla.
Yeah, it was a fantastic end to the game. Ronaldo puts Real Madrid's ahead. They looked like they were on course for what would have been a really good win against a side who have impressed so much under Jorge Sampaoli. And then 2 goals in the last 5 minutes, which Graham Hunter retweeted a tweet. And stats don't always say. But apparently it's only the second time in Real Madrid's history that they have been 1-0 up that late into a game and then lost.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't expect it to happen to them many times.
Well, not many times, maybe more than
once.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Sergio Ramos, so often the hero of late goals. And by the way, this was hot on the heels from a 3-3 draw in the Cup when Real Madrid scored twice late to draw 3-3.
Mm.
This time, losing. Sergio Ramos' own goal, one of the best own goals,
he
I think.
He blasted it into the net, didn't he, with his head?
If that had have been a goal at the other end, you'd be like, oh, he is... Well, he just comes up with big goals at the right time. And then Stefan Jovetic, on his league debut, having scored on his debut in the Cup, having signed from Inter with the winner in the 91st minute. Great moment for him. Awful goalkeeping from Keylor Navas, who for some reason positioned himself.
It was the positioning for that goal, wasn't it? Do you want to describe the goal from Jovetic?
So Jovetic is running on the left-hand side. He's cutting into his right foot. The only place he can realistically score is in the top right-hand corner as he hits it. Goalkeeper's top left-hand
corner. About 25 yards out, would you say?
Keylor Navas, for some reason, where he's just out of position, stands almost by his right-hand post, which gives the striker the whole of that side of the goal. Now, Jovetic's effort, he got a hand to it, Keylor Navas. When you actually, at first, you thought, yeah, that's brilliant. He must have curled it into the top right-hand corner, but he didn't, actually. His shot was only just not that far away from the middle of the goal.
Yeah, it was very central. When you saw it behind and you could see the positioning of Navas, I think as well, he tipped that thinking, that's going around the post. Yeah. That wasn't like, oh, I've only got a fingertip on that.
Yeah.
And then he looked back and was like, oh, wow.
Because had he been in the position, he would have tipped it comfortably.
Exactly.
But he wasn't. And massive win for Sevilla. I mean, we'll talk, you know, Real Madrid's unbeaten run is the headline, if you like. But, well, A, there looks like there's a title race on now. They're only a point behind Real Madrid, albeit Madrid have a game in hand. Barcelona are only 2 points behind. But from Sevilla's point of view, they brought in Jovetic, who looks like he's fitted in already. Nzonzi was magnificent.
What amazed me about Nzonzi is how advanced. In my head, he's that guy who breaks it up and moves it out. He can drive forward with it. But he was so far up the pitch winning possession at times. That amazed me. I think that must be a Sampaoli thing.
Yeah, he's a bit like the Pogba position in terms of, you know, other players that slightly release him whilst he still does that defensive. Sampaoli called him an octopus, which was very apt given his performance. He was everywhere. You can see why. You know, I think they may struggle to keep hold of him, potentially, if you believe the rumours. But, you know, we did a Champions League podcast. I tipped them as dark horses. Maybe to go all the way is a big shout in the round of 16. But I think they will beat Leicester. And I think Leicester fans watching that would have realised that.
Yeah, on the two weekend performances, you'd think you're in a bit of trouble.
Very, very difficult tie. But from Sevilla's point of view, Sampaoli has done a magnificent job there. And they are... Whenever you watch them, you think something's going to happen here, off the pitch or on the touchline or on the pitch, and invariably it does. They're brilliant to watch. And what he did at 1-1 was he didn't say, OK, this is Real Madrid, we'll settle for a point. He flung on a striker and fortune favoured the brave.
It certainly did. Gav tweeted in to say, the stunning Sampaoli and his beautiful shiny head defeating the other shiny head. It was his highlight of the weekend. Worth noting as well that Ramos was getting booed after scoring a Panenka penalty in the Cup win in the week. It was seen by some as disrespectful, which I think is absolutely ludicrous.
It's not disrespectful. He's playing for the opposition. But there was one of those, you look at, you know.
Because the thing was that Real Madrid were probably going through anyway and he still did that.
Well, yeah.
But I don't agree. No, I don't agree.
It's not disrespectful. Some of the abuse he got was a little...
It was way over the top. Yeah,
he's a footballer and he can do anything he wants with that penalty.
He certainly can. They're through in the Copa del Rey, but they've lost that big advantage that they had at the top of the table. Still have a game in hand, Real Madrid, on 40 points. Sevilla have 39, Barca have 38. Atletico, after a hard-fought 1-0 win over Real Betis at home, are on 34. Can Sevilla last the distance in that title race?
Why not? I mean, we've seen Atletico do it. As I said, they do have the Champions League, which, you know, I think will take, certainly in those weekends before and after that, you know, that is a huge opportunity for them to reach the quarterfinals, which hasn't happened, never happened in the Champions League era for Sevilla. Some good news, Monchi, who the sporting director, who continues to bring in excellent players. He's been linked consistently, because you almost have that transfer market now, don't you, in terms of sporting directors as much as players.
Certainly in Germany you do, yeah.
Certainly in Germany. But he's said that he's staying, which I think is a huge bonus for the club. You look, I think £180 million profit from selling players since he's been there.
Isn't that incredible?
Isn't that incredible? As well as improving the team. They're getting better.
Yeah, they've progressed while making money.
Which is perfect. Another story, Rob, in Spain, which you can describe. Lionel Messi, okay? He is the messiah at Barcelona. Mm. And they have sacked a director, haven't they? Because allegedly he made some disrespectful comment.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're coming up to this Messi contract, and it is getting a little bit messy in terms of how the club are dealing with it. Because Messi's current contract, I find this hard to believe, expires in the summer of 2018. So Barca have let that run.
Yeah, they have.
Or that's been let to run with a year and a half to go, which is the kind of thing Arsenal will end up doing, isn't it? And then, or were doing, and we're getting themselves
in trouble.
It's going
to end up Manchester City.
Exactly. So at the weekend, by the way, Barcelona did win 5-0 against Las Palmas. Alex Vidal scored in that game, a player who Luis Enrique says has proved him wrong. But all the talk around Barcelona this week has been about this Messi contract issue. Now, the reason being, that some of the directors have spoken about the Messi contract situation. The CEO says, you know, we have to be realistic in terms of what we offer Lionel Messi. You would have thought just offer him whatever, but the club, you know, maybe playing a little bit of hardball. But it's this comment from Barcelona director Pere Gratacos, who was the club's head of sports international relations with the Royal Spanish Football Federation. He said this after the Copa del Rey draw. Leo is one of the most important people in the team, but it's not just about him. He would not be as good without Iniesta, Neymar and company, not Vincent. But Messi, and then he says, but Messi is the best. Gratacos, a former Barcelona B player.
Well, he's right, isn't he?
He's right. And the club, Barcelona, took the move to sack him from his position. I'm sure some people did see that story last week. This is a fear factor of the highest level, isn't it, Chris, about the Messi's future with Barcelona?
Would seem to be the fear of him being upset. I reckon if you asked Lionel Messi, he would say, well, of course I'm not as good without Iniesta supplying the balls, Neymar and Suarez. I find that what he said there is absolutely true. He's also then said at the end, but Messi is the best. I think that is whether this is politics coming in, and I am purely speculating here, but maybe some people had an axe to grind with Gratacos.
Possibly, yeah.
Because otherwise that seems wholly... I mean,
it could be that they're worried. This is the kind of behaviour, irrational behaviour, that you take part in if you're concerned about the situation.
True. I mean, also, it just says, you know, that thing of no one is bigger than the club. Lionel Messi is bigger than the club, clearly, if that's happening.
Yeah, because, exactly.
And I'm not saying it's Lionel Messi here, but the fear of Messi's team taking that the wrong way, as opposed to the player himself, who is probably, like every footballer, mostly bothered about what happens on the pitch and having a good time with his mates, which is what he should be bothered about. But I just find that he's right. Everything he said there is right, and for him to be sacked for that just seems...
Well, it would be, let's put it out there, because I've seen, I think, the likes of Graham Hunt and Guillaume Balague tweeting about the potential of Messi leaving, and then them getting a bit of stick, because people say, I can't imagine him ever leaving. But it isn't infeasible. So should we ask people for next week's show, could you see Lionel Messi leaving Barcelona in the future?
And where would he go?
Yeah, let's have that all out next week.
I mean, that is fascinating, because who would it would almost be an arms race in terms of who would offer him the most money.
Nuts.
And I can think of a country with an awful lot of cash that would be very interested.
Yeah, and well, I think we should probably talk about China a bit more on a future show as well, because obviously we're coming towards the end of the transfer window here, or we're midway through the window, and lots of stuff is happening with that. Okay, I think we've sort of covered La Liga. By the way, on Monchi, who we talked about before, the Sevilla sporting director, there's a great article on the Varsity website where Monchi talks about his 16 teams of scouts, 16 scouts, and how they spend 5 months watching every player and how they look at statistical data. They have 700 players, they whittle that down. Really interesting, worth reading as well. Chris, couple of deals in the Bundesliga, both to Bayern, who are...
That's a surprise.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Small team does well, smaller team does well, best players go to Bayern. League suffers. That's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Two Hoffenheim players. I must admit, I haven't seen as much as you, Nicolas Süle, is that correct?
Süle, yeah, Süle.
€20 million in Sebastian Rudi. Yeah, I said I haven't seen much of them, but Hoffenheim, who are now the only unbeaten side in the top five divisions.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, although they have drawn 10 of their 16 games. But still very impressive.
Still impressive.
But, you know, this does happen. It happens in every league, but I think in my head it particularly does happen in the Bundesliga, that if, you know, it tends to be Bayern that will get these guys as opposed to a a Dortmund or someone else coming in for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Hollywood club, isn't it, if you're in Germany? I suppose that's the issue. I mean, Rudy's an interesting one. He will be a squad player there. He's a captain of Hoffenheim, but I can't see Bayern really using him. I wonder if he'll sort of almost be the Sebastian Roda type
right, yeah.
squad player replacement after Roda left, ironically, for Dortmund in the summer. A bit about Sula as well. 6'5", Chelsea were heavily linked with him. He made his international debut this year. He played at the Olympics for Germany. And I saw Rafa Honigstein on BT Sport last night saying he will be Germany's next centre-back. And I presume, because how often do you see Martinez injured, Boateng yeah. injured, you even see Hummels injured?
Yeah,
you know, they're certainly thinking about their future. Also, I saw this from Uli Hoeneß, Chris. I read this in the Mirror. He said, "At Bayern, more Germans need to. We need more Germans. More German needs to be spoken in the change room." So obviously, he's back at president after his recent election. He said, "I'd like to see."
What were you going to say after his recent?
Oh yeah,
his recent stay at Her Majesty's pleasure.
I would like as many Germans as possible to play for us. Because Hoeneß then also said, "I know Arsenal sometimes play without a single English player. For me, that is unimaginable."
That's pretty strong, isn't it?
Mm.
First of all, saying more German needs to be spoken in the changing room. And then having a little dig at your next opponents in the Champions League as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Completely forgot about that. Okay. So that's La Liga and Bundesliga back on Friday, of course, when Freiburg take on Bayern. But let's turn our attention now to Serbian football.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
Joining us now is football journalist Sonja Nikcevic to talk about Serbian football. Sonja, thank you very much for joining us on Football in Europe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, it's great to have you back on, Sonja. We've had you on a couple of times to talk about the Belgrade derby. And we're going to focus on things in Belgrade at the moment because Partizan Belgrade have been banned from the Champions League and Europa League for the next three seasons. Can you explain why this has happened to one of the iconic names in Serbian football?
Absolutely. Now, this came as a complete shock to Partizan and all of Serbian football and European football last week when UEFA sent out the news to Partizan, and this is the interesting fact. So the news about Partizan's ban was never officially delivered to media, and there wasn't an official statement about it. It was something that was just delivered to Partizan, to the club itself, and that's how the news came out. And this is where there's actually been some confusion. So big outlets, including the BBC, big international outlets, including AP, came out with the news that Partizan has been banned for three seasons, while actually the case is, and this is what Serbian media have actually stressed, is that the club isn't banned for three seasons. They will be banned for the first season in the next three that they manage to qualify for Europe, so for the Europa League or for the Champions League. So the ban isn't actually effective three seasons. It's effective one season in the next three where Partizan qualified to. The reason that the ban came out is because of unpaid debts for the club, which people from UEFA have confirmed to media is at 2.5 million euros, which is an incredible amount.
From Partizan's point of view, do they have the right to reply? Are they obviously they're not happy, but you know, what's been their attitude towards what UEFA have said?
Well, from Partizan's side, there's been almost an absolute denial of the fact that the ban even came out. And they're the ones who were convincing media from the very start that this is not true, that the ban actually isn't in place, but that it's more of a case of kind of like a final warning, and that if debts are paid by the 31st of January, that actually Partizan will not be banned. In the meantime, media in Serbia have contacted UEFA, and UEFA have confirmed that the ban is in place whether or not Partizan settle their debts by the 31st of January or not. And the thing is that UEFA are talking about this number of 2.5 million euros, while the club are talking about a debt of 360,000 euros, which I'm sure we'll agree is actually a very big difference. And in the meantime, there have been reports that Partizan's general sponsor, Telecom Serbia, have paid them the amount of 360,000 euros, which they will then be able to settle by the end of the month. But UEFA insists that this will not change anything. And the fact that the club have been provisionally suspended in the previous year and that this is their third offense in the last 5 years in terms of unpaid debts and unpaid taxes to to the country, to Serbia's national tax services. This means that UEFA needed to actually take action and to ban the club in, as we can remember, the same way that Red Star was also banned seasons before, where as champions, they were banned from the Champions League, and it was Partizan who actually took their place in qualification for Europe. So this is something that unfortunately has been common in Serbian football, and it's something that we see as kind of like a vicious circle, because Partizan actually count on money from European competitions in order to pay off their most outstanding debts and the debts that they keep on building from previous seasons. And one season of not playing Europe means one more year of not being able to pay off previous debt.
Obviously, I mean, Partizan is such a huge club, Sonia, one that has reached the European Cup final, I should say. What has been the reaction in Serbian media? Is there a general concern about the state of Partizan and their potential exclusion from one season of European football?
Absolutely. I mean, the impact of this has reverberated all throughout Serbia. And the question now is that Partizan have been on a great run after a little bit of a shaky start that was actually something that spilled over from a very shaky season previously. Is that after that start where Partizan kind of lost hold on the race with Red Star and went into the Belgrade Derby with a 9-point deficit, Partizan managed to turn that over, managed to beat Red Star in the derby with a last-minute goal. And since then, they've actually been on a 17-match winning streak, 17-match without defeat. And the attitude around the club and the atmosphere has been that the 6-point difference between Red Star is something that in the spring part of the season can be turned around and that Partizan actually could be champions. But that has now all been kind of put under question, given that the UEFA ban has shaken things in the club. And questions have now been asked about whether Partizan will have to sell some of their best players in order to work towards changing that debt. And currently the question is the Brazilian, Leonardo, who has been the top scorer in the Serbian League this season with 12 goals and who has saved Partizan in a number of situations, including that Belgrade derby where he scored the only goal in the match. And the question is, will he now be sold? Will the other Brazilian, Everton, in the club also be sold? And will all forces now be put on the domestic league in terms of winning that title to give the fans at least something? Because the fact that not playing Europe is a big blow to fans as well, because they see it as obviously playing the Champions League or Europa League, or even playing the last round of qualifiers for such a level of competition is a very big deal for Serbian football, and that's something that now Partizan won't have.
Sonia, the next Belgrade derby is next month, always a brilliant occasion. Generally in Serbia, is everyone on Partizan's side, or are Red Star fans looking at them and sort of with a wry smile, having had that themselves a couple of years ago from UEFA?
Absolutely. The thing is that the majority of Red Star fans will be looking on the situation with a wry smile. I think that the majority have not gotten over the fact that it was Partizan that went into Europe on the season that Red Star were champions. And this is something that will not be forgotten for a long time, especially because at the time, Partizan fans had more than a wry smile for Red Star and for their fans. So, I mean, it's something that will not go down well in any camp, obviously, being banned from Europe, but that the other side will definitely appreciate to a certain point. And what we have to say is that it's a question that's being asked for a long time. Partizan's youth academy has been one of the most prolific in the past 5 years, with the Observatory for Football having given stats that Partizan is the club that has the most homegrown talent playing in Europe's 31 leagues. And the question is, if so many players are being given chances to play in Europe and being sold in Europe, why does the club still have so much debt?
Exactly,
and this is questions that fans have asked president of the club, that have asked the board of the club, and there are no answers. The only answer is that the real amount of debt that's been on for years has been hidden, and that the money that is coming in is not being used to settle any debts, but is being used so that for bonuses for members of the executive board. And this is an issue that exists all throughout Serbian football, and that money coming in is not money that actually goes to the club itself.
Okay, let's talk about an academy product of Red Star then, in Marko Grujic, who joined Liverpool in principle back in January of last year, but joined on a permanent deal almost in the summer. He's barely played, Sonia, and he has earned caps for the senior national team, part of the under-20 team that won the World Cup back in 2015. Grujic, I read a quote from him saying he thinks next year is going to be his breakthrough season. But you think there's concern that, you know, he's only made two sub-Premier League appearances this season, that Grujic is wasting a campaign in essence?
Well, for Marko Grujic, there was so much talk about him moving to Liverpool. And when we talked previously about this on the podcast here, it was a big case of Grujic's father, who is actually a sports journalist himself, being completely against the move to Liverpool, saying, I don't want my son to become yet another player who will sign for a big club and then be shipped off to a small club as soon as the deal goes through. And to a certain extent, Grujic's father is right that his son isn't actually getting the chance to play, and that possibly staying in Red Star, who is currently doing very well in the league, who has the chance to become champion and play Europe, could have been much better experience for Marko Grujic than actually coming to Liverpool and, as his father said, sitting on the bench or being shipped off to a club that isn't the club he actually signed for. And what we have to remember here with Grujic is that he actually started really well in the preseason when he actually came to the Premier League. He played a couple of very good matches in the preseason for Liverpool, and unluckily, he got injured. He had a head injury in one of those matches that meant that he was out for a month, and that, I think, to a certain extent, stumped that first phase that he might have been, first chances that he might have actually been given in Liverpool, and gave way to other players to be given chances over him. Of course, since then, Grujic has recuperated. He's fine now. And he's still a very, very good player, one that could do really well in the Premier League, given his build, given how well he does in the air, how quick he is. And in terms of physicality, experts have compared him to Paul Pogba, in who's doing really well in Europe, maybe not yesterday particularly, but other than that, who has had a good start in United finally. And Grujic has that same physicality. He just needs the experience. And now it's up to Liverpool to see how they're going to tap into that talent and that potential for him. And if the answer is him being sent to another club, it doesn't have to be the end of the world, but he needs to have match experience. It's just a question of how he's going to get it and if that will lead to chances being given to him in Liverpool.
Sonia, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Maybe we'll chat to you again after the next Belgrade derby, one of the best in Europe.
Absolutely. Looking forward to talking about Partizan only having a 3-point deficit after that derby.
Sonia, thank you very much.
For more, head to the website footballineurope.co.uk.
A reminder, Football in Europe is sponsored by betonbrazil.com. It's the betting site for all sports punters with great odds markets and offers. Listeners to this podcast can now get up to £60 deposit match when you use the promo code FIE60. Just visit betonbrazil.com and enter promo code FIE60 when you deposit, and we'll match your deposit up to £60. Also look out for our daily happy hour offers between 5 and 6pm. Sign up now at betonbrazil.com. Betonbrazil.com is for over 18s only. Betting should be fun, so please gamble responsibly. Chris, people may fancy a punt on the African Cup of Nations, which has got underway. Obviously, out of the realms of European football, but there's lots of players from the continent, who, including Sadio Mane, who couldn't feature for Liverpool, and this bizarre thing with Joel Matip, where he couldn't play against Manchester United. But who are some of the key players that you might fancy having a look out for at the tournament?
Well, first of all, notoriously difficult to predict the African Cup of Nations if you are fancying a punt. I think we saw Zimbabwe drawing with Algeria. Riyad Mahrez scoring twice. He's obviously there. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is there with Gabon. Kalidou Koulibaly, Napoli centre-half with Senegal. Anderlecht, you know, there are certain teams who are harmed to the wrong word, because if you sign an African player, then you should expect that they're going to go to their major tournament.
Yep.
But Anderlecht have four players there. Manchester United without Eric Bailly at the moment, of course. So some big important names. I mean, Aubameyang is maybe the biggest in terms of how Dortmund cope. Although given when the German league doesn't start again until this weekend, actually, it's quite nicely positioned, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
If it was any later on in the year, then it might be slightly more damaging for clubs. But I had a look through, and I hope this isn't offensive to any Zimbabwe listeners, but the first names of their players, some of them are absolutely glorious. Check this out, okay? They had in their squad against Algeria someone called Marvelous.
Yeah.
Someone called Hard Life. Someone called Teenage. And someone called Bruce.
They're the best. Why don't we have names like this?
Yeah, but who's called Bruce as well?
Bruce.
Like, could it not have been called Marvellous?
Bruce Rioch.
Bruce Rioch, yeah.
Yeah, everyone's got cool names, like Hard Life, and you're called Bruce. Bruce.
And Chris,
Kenny here?
Has anyone seen Dave?
Yeah. I think it's on Eurosport, I think, isn't it, this year, African Cup of Nations, for viewers in the UK. So we'll keep up to date that, and we'll obviously... Once the tournament is concluded, we'll talk about the final as well. But Chris, we want to talk about the Eredivisie, because there was a notable son of an Ajax legend who got some game time.
Yes, and made everyone feel immediately 10 or 20 years older, because Patrick Kluivert's son made his first team debut this weekend, born May 1999.
Oh, so he's like 17, is he, or something?
He is.
What's that?
He is 17, yeah.
No.
Phenomenal. He only made his young Ajax debut this season as well. So he's progressed pretty quickly to the first team. Came on after 39 minutes against Zwolle.
Did he score?
He didn't score, but he did play well.
Okay.
On the right wing. But, and he looks, Justin Kluivert looks like his father. 17... and as I said, it makes you, given I remember Patrick Kluivert playing, I don't remember him scoring the winner in the 95 final, actually, but I have interviewed him about that, and now you think, wow, his son is already a first-team player at Ajax.
Yeah, 17. Kluivert himself, Patrick Kluivert, is only 40 years old. Just Google that. So, obviously, Patrick Kluivert these days... is sporting director at Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah.
Where he's making the big signings.
Big job.
It's a huge job. And I suppose one of his latest big signings has really started to pay off already.
Yeah. Julian Draxler, who, you know, was... Patrick Kluivert came out before the winter break and said attacking midfield wasn't necessarily the position we want. We're looking for a striker.
Striker, yeah.
Although, given he is in that role, you don't come out and say, yeah, we're desperate for Julian Draxler. Otherwise, Wolfsburg say, okay, well...
We'll have 5 mil to that.
Yeah. So... he's made a sparkling start, scored on his debut in the Cup against Bastia, and now scored on his league debut, the only goal against Rennes. Big win, and he started very well. And what it does is it puts an awful lot of pressure on. I think we alluded to it last week, but he started, Ben Arfa and Di Maria, both on the bench.
Di Maria on the bench.
He played the left alongside Cavani and Lucas up front. Great start for Draxler, but as I said, they do have a lot of attacking midfielders, and you know, the idea of Di Maria not being in Paris Saint-Germain's first choice team.
Yeah, unthinkable. Almost.
Although here's a stat for you. Julian Draxler has now scored as many league goals this season as Angel Di Maria.
It was a wonderful goal as well from the edge of the penalty area. He just placed it into the far corner. And I actually think Draxler on the left wing was where he looked so effective there for Germany at the Euros in the summer. That might be he can glide past players, and I also saw, I think it was on BT the other day, they were saying about how Joshua Gilavugi, who he played with at Wolfsburg, said that Draxler was like obsessed with French culture, so he was always sort of maybe angling for that kind of move.
And he's there with Kevin Trapp as well, isn't he?
He is, who apparently are best buds.
Yeah.
Best buds already.
Best buds.
So PSG really needed that victory, Chris, because of the other title contenders in Monaco and Nice. I know that Nice drew at the weekend against Metz, so that's more drop points for them. But tell us about how Monaco got on.
They absolutely thumped Marseille away from home in the Velodrome. That sort of Provence derby. But they were brilliant again. To put this into context, Marseille, under Rudy Garcia, now, of course, had conceded one goal at home all season. Mm. Monaco ride into town and hit four.
They are scoring so many goals, aren't they?
So many goals. So Tomé Lemar got the opener, Falcao scored, and Bernardo Silva got two. Had a quick look into this, okay? So Monaco, the first stat is that Marseille conceded once at home all season. They got four. Falcao now has as many league goals as Ronaldo and Lewandowski. And check this out for a change in philosophy, I think, from Leonardo Jardim, which we've touched upon before. Two seasons ago, they scored 51 goals in the season. Last season, they scored 57 goals in the whole campaign. This season, already, they have reached 60 goals.
Wow.
In 20 matches. I'm bad at maths, but that is three per game.
And that's 21 more than Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah.
That is staggering.
It is staggering.
This comes to a tweet that we've had from Rich Allen. He says, a question for the podcast. Is the Monaco midfield four of Fabinho, Bakayoko, Bernardo Silva and Lemar the best to watch in Europe this season? And what that immediately made me think of was, because I don't cover Liga on a regular basis, but sort of the Spurs game, watch that Spurs game where Monaco beat them at home. And it was that midfield four. And that was, I felt breathless, dynamic, attacking, strong. Spurs were overwhelmed.
You felt breathless?
Oh, it was. Well, I think Spurs did.
Yeah, they did.
They didn't have a clue what to do. They were fortunate to get level in that game. And I think we've said it before that this might be that sort of Porto team in 2004 where you look back and you go, how bizarre they were all at that team at the same time.
Well, I mean, as you said that, and it's a very good point, I can't think of a midfield unit that have played better together this season.
No.
Certainly not in the top five. Okay.
And certainly not to watch. I mean, you were talking about Chelsea before. Because Kante and Matic are really effective.
But yeah, no, you're right to watch. Mm. They give the basis, don't they, for Pedro Hazard and, well, was Costa, might still be Costa. But yeah, I mean, they and they're so young as well.
You know, Monaco,
I presume anyway, will keep hold of all these players for this transfer window. Come the summer, they've got big decisions to make because they're, you know, if they carry on like this, you know, yeah. Are they favourites to win Ligue 1? They must be the way they're playing.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how much this Draxler signing rejuvenates Paris Saint-Germain. It is only 3 points.
It is only 3 points, it's
and
true.
Both of them are still in the Champions League. I mean, Paris Saint-Germain, we don't know for how much longer because they've got... I mean, both teams have got tough ties, but if Monaco play the way they play and City play the way they played against Everton at the weekend, which was horrendous...
Well, I mean, if you're Monaco, you look at that, you look at the goalkeeper and then you look at the...
centre of defence.
The centre of defence.
John Stones, what on earth was he on?
And even because of the way they played, the protection that City get from their midfield as well.
Touré's not offering that, is he, at the moment?
Well, he can't do it on his own. You know, Guardiola's going to have big decisions before that Champions League match because, you know, Jardim is a bit of a tactical magician as well. And with those players... They must be, because they're so young and fearless, they must be licking their lips thinking City will still, everyone will still say that City are favourites. Not many people watch Ligue 1. Let's go there and let's go for them. Mm. Go for the kill. They should do.
Yeah, and if they make that City crowd anxious at home, it would be that'd be very interesting. There's another story in French football that I wanted to touch upon, Chris, and that is the situation with Memphis Depay, very much on the periphery of Manchester United. Lyon have had a relatively low bid, I think it'd be fair to say. It was something like, was it £12 million or something like that? You're not going to get Memphis Depay for that.
It's almost as derisory as a West Ham's bid for the likes of Robert Snodgrass.
Oh, the Defoe bit.
And the Defoe.
Oh, my God. Okay, so...
But also, I was going to say West Brom's and Morgan Schneiderlin as well. It's just
what was that? What did that have?
I think it was 13 plus add-ons. And it's like, no. Give us a proper bid and we'll have a think about it.
So what do you think to the Depay situation,
well,
Chris?
Often you think, well, is this just a transfer rumour? But it's one of the rare times that, you know, Bruno Genesio has come out and said, I've put priority on Memphis Depay. Things are progressing. We keep on working. It takes time because recruiting a player now is not easy. But he has come out and called Depay his number one priority. Would Depay want to go to Lyon? I think it would be if you're signing the guy who was at PSV anyway, Memphis Depay was one of the hottest properties in European football. He's he's fallen off the radar. I think there's
20 minutes of Premier League football this season for Memphis Depay.
There's certainly allegations about his attitude, I think.
That's been an issue for a long time, hasn't it?
It has,
people,
yeah.
And criticism levelled at him.
But maybe Ligue 1 is the right environment for him then.
For now, it's becoming like the league where you can like
rebuild.
You come back, league.
You come back.
It's like
league.
Your Matthew McConaughey league.
So you sort of think, yeah, actually, maybe it would be a good move. But can Leon afford him his wages, and can they afford the transfer fee?
Would they loan him? Could United loan him?
Well,
have they got too much going on with the Europa League. Do they need?
Well, this is the thing about United is that they do have a massive amount of games because they're in the League Cup. Mm. Favourites to reach the final. They're in the Europa League, they're in the FA Cup, and they're in the Premier League. So they really are fighting on four fronts, which I think means that they don't need to loan Memphis Depay. If someone's going to offer the money for him, I think this is the case of Everton, who maybe wanted him on loan, and maybe still do. But if someone wants Memphis Depay, I think they might have to buy him, because United can have him as a squad player with all those games and would still back him to produce something if they needed him on the pitch.
Sure. Yeah, it's going to be... I think the Europa League might be the decisive factor in them keeping Memphis Depay. OK, we'll monitor that because we still do have a couple of weeks of the transfer window to go. Chris, I think we're heading to Italy next. Let's do a quick roundup of Italy because we've got to talk about Stau, which is like one of the big stories of the week as well. In Italy, Juve beaten.
Yes, and now just one clear of Roma. And they lost 2-1 in Florence. Kalinic and Bedelli put Fiorentina 2 up. I saw Nicola Kalinic linked with a move away from Fiorentina.
£45 million was the fee they were talking about. Because you had to match his buyout.
Blackburn couldn't have got 450 grand.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
So yeah, always a great game when those two rivals meet. And Juve now have lost 4 times in Serie A, which I had a look, one less than the whole of last season. They have a game in hand, but they're one clear of Roma, who won, but maybe my moment of the weekend, Edin Dzeko with a penalty. It was Baggio in 94.
Oh, it was horrendous,
and
wasn't
worse.
It? Yeah.
I think it's still travelling towards the moon as we speak. But yeah, they did win that game, Roma, and they keep on, you know, it could
they
be
were
interesting.
My tip to challenge them. They were my ones to challenge Juve at the start of the season, and you went for...
No, top
can
four.
You remember who you went for? No, it wasn't, Chris. It wasn't. It was who's going to challenge Juve.
No,
what did
it was
you say?
Top four in all divisions. And I foolishly said Inter.
Oh, did you? Is that what it was?
Yeah, it's top four. Because we all knew it was going to be Roma to challenge.
No, be it. All right, I'm going to look back at that. Double check.
Ooh, this could be exciting.
Okay, a lovely goal by Raja Nangalan as well in that game, a sort of volley on the turn.
His tats are mental. Right, so.
I was expecting you to say that.
So, Francesco Totti. You know, one of these Instagram posts. God, I sound like I'm 60.
Oh, good.
And
by the way, it's something like the 25th calendar year that he's played in Serie A.
Is it?
When he came on. Yeah.
But there was a picture, and honestly, because obviously you see Nangalan's sleeves and things, but he's full torso as well.
He's terrifying, isn't he?
He is terrifying. Very good player.
That's why I'd let him have a smoke. If I was his manager, I'd be like, okay, you do what you want.
That might be the reason you're not manager of Roma.
Inter continued their renaissance under Stefano Pioli after a win over Chievo. And Napoli got a 3-1 win over Pescara. And Milik not on the bench. That was rumoured, Chris, was it?
Yeah, well, it was... Sarri said that he'd been... It's been a miraculous recovery, but I still did think it would be very...
Yeah,
early.
Let's be careful.
You know, yeah, be very careful, absolutely.
Okay, so do you want to tell us a story of Steaua Bucharest, Chris?
Did you know they have the longest current unbeaten record in
Well,
Europe?
Can you give me something else?
I can.
The 1986 European Cup winners will be known as Steaua no more.
Steaua no more. They're going to be called FC Star.
Is that what Steaua is then, being really... It's
maybe.
Moronic. Let me Google that while you tell us the story.
My Romanian isn't up to scratch, but it may be. But basically, they lost a court case against the country's defence ministry last month, which the
defence ministry.
Yeah, because
that is crazy.
Because
isn't it?
They are the defence side. I think that's correct. It was brought against them, and they were found to have illegally been using the name of an army side. Gigi Becali, who's things are never dull when he is around. He's not a particularly nice man, I don't think either.
Bizarre owner, yeah.
Bizarre owner has changed the name to FC Star, and they were found to have illegally used the Steaua brand since 2004, which is a long time.
Wow.
13 years. So, yeah, they have they have revealed the rename. And I didn't quite realise that Becali had separated the club from the State Sports Club in 98, which is why this was brought about.
Well, I'm just reading here. On the ministry called the court ruling well-deserved and said they're going to sue them £34 million. They're going to sue Becali Stour for that money.
That is
crazy.
But well, that is, it's crazy when the Ministry of Defence is suing a football club.
Is this all... I mean, I know nothing about this story, but is this some sort of like big... Eventually, they've got their revenge for him pulling the team away from the
quite possibly
from the state or something.
Maybe we should look. Maybe we should look to get
Let's speak
someone
to someone who knows what they're talking about.
Because they are a huge club, and you know, and also, you know, purely selfishly, I love saying Steaua Bucharest. Cool
I know.
Name.
Well, it is Steaua in English. It's Steaua in Romanian.
So now they're going to be called FC
Steaua.
FC Steaua. I don't like clubs who FC's at the start of their name, not the end.
What?
You know, FC Star.
Yeah, but Chris, that's a European...
I could have called it Star FC.
Star FC.
If you're going to call it Star...
You're losing me here with this.
But anyway, Star are going to be called FC Star.
Okay.
That's essentially it.
Yeah, okay. The final thing we want to talk about very quickly, World Cup expansion.
How long have we got?
I mean, yeah, not long, actually. We're supposed to be leaving this studio. The FIFA Council's rubber stamp plans to expand the World Cup in 2026 to 48 teams. So we add 16 nations.
Yes, we do.
Very easily voted through.
Yes, I voted on 4 proposals and could have stayed with the current 32-team competition. It has changed relatively recently, I think. 1998, they had an expansion. We find out in May exactly where those new 16 nations will come. But certainly Europe's share of the nations, which actually, when you look at it, I think is too much, will be reduced. There'll still be more European clubs. I think maybe 3 more spots. So there'll be 16. So there'll still be one European team in each group. But it would be much less of a share. I had a look at the moment. Africa only gets, I think, 4 automatic spots. Which for a continent with some very big footballing nations isn't that much.
I also saw the argument, because obviously there was a lot of people upset that this, everyone likes the 32-team format, and I thought the World Cup in Brazil was great. One of the arguments I saw put forward that was there are now members of FIFA. There are more countries who are FIFA members, and that's increased year by year. So really the World Cup has to increase proportionately, otherwise it's not necessarily... Well, not necessarily fair.
It is, and this is one of the arguments for keeping it the same, I know, but certainly in Europe, it's now much harder to qualify for the World Cup than it is for the European Championships because of the increase.
But the worry is the format, isn't it? I don't think I'm too concerned about 48 teams, but it's the way that's split up.
Well, it's also because clubs would get very upset if it was longer than the 32-day schedule that it is at the moment. So this is one of the reasons this one was passed through so easily, because they don't get into a battle with big clubs because they can still play in that 32-day window. 80 games now instead of 64. But I think the pathway to winning it is the same in terms of how many games you have to play if you reach the final and won it.
So you get through your group and then it's a round of...
It's a round of 16 still. So you don't... Not that you could, you know, there's... But the one thing I hope they don't do, so it would be slightly odd to have groups of 3 because the top 2 will go through.
No, they would, but they wouldn't, because if it's a round of 16...
Yeah, no, it would be...
One team would go through, 48 divided by 3 is 16.
Yeah,
and... So that means one team goes through from every...
No, top 2.
48.
Round of 16, and then...
Hold on, but that means 32 teams would get...
Yeah, 32 teams go through.
Oh, no, but we don't have a round of... We have 32 teams at the World Cup now. 2 teams going in each group stage. We're left with 16.
Are we on air at the moment? do you think this is what's happening?
Hold on, Chris, why is this not working? What are we doing wrong? Round of 16 is you have 16 teams.
So it'd be a round of 32 then.
So that is another game.
This is what's happened. Anyway, very good point. So what happens is...
No, you're right. Okay, so it says 16 groups of 3 and the top 2 will go through to a round of 32. So there will be one... no, we won't lose a game because there's one less group game.
One less group game.
I bet there's people screaming at their iPhone. Did you do that?
I only did NAFS up to GCSE.
I might take a photo of the mad sums I've just done on my notes. Okay, so
same amount of games.
Yeah.
There is a last 32.
Yeah.
And two teams will go through from every group with three sides. Now, this is where it might get complicated. And this is what I hope they do not do, is introduce penalty shootouts in turn, because otherwise they think it might get very complicated with who goes through, because...
Penalty shootouts for what? The group
in
stage?
In group stage, so you don't have any draws.
So everyone does a...
Apparently. Possibly.
That would be funny though, wouldn't it?
Oh no, but that to me is too much of a change.
That's not even the sport anymore.
Draws are part of football.
They are. Oh, we can't have draws in the group stage.
Can't have draws in the group stage.
I'm not listening to anything you're saying.
So that is the World Cup, and what we've done there is we've been
confused.
We've been very. We've now put out a confusing statement, okay. And we're just as bad as
we've
FIFA.
We've ruined it. Okay, Chris, I think we're done. Yeah,
people are saying phew.
Phew, thank God.
Get on with my day.
Okay,
now, please?
So tell us, could you see Messi going? Is it realistic? And who could get him? That's what we want for the next one.
Yeah.
Chris, you're not here next Monday.
I'm not here next Monday.
So I'm going to have this debate on my own with the masses. You've left, drop that bombshell. But thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back on Monday.
See ya.
You're listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.